Walk in confidence, hope. Look, the promised land is eagerly awaiting your auspicious arrival. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 15. A Soul in Solo. As always, the master seemed to be operating in many different realms at once, while tending countless details on earth, his inner agility yet more apparent in the relative intimacy of the Christmas trip. He encouraged a daily intake of innocent enjoyment and entertainment, but never left us time for idleness, lest we lose our capacities or inspiration. He believed there could be no such thing as staying still in the spiritual life. Either we go forward or we roll back to some previous plateau. There was simply no keeping up with his spry leaps across the inner peaks, but we each had our own pace and activity, as though tailored to our personal ascent. A day with him was a world to me. Others had their own simultaneous worlds, where it probably seemed he was for them only. Outside the functions, the halls and corridors echoed with his new songs as different groups practiced to perform them. Even if he was not visible to all, he would surely be creating, composing, exercising, or offering his guidance in words and meditation. Sri Chinmoy had use of an annex to our function room in Singapore, where he could withdraw alone or speak privately with people. 9 members of Pari's group were present and would sometimes be invited there to sing or to take dictation. Although it was only a side room in a hotel, perhaps used for cocktail parties or storage the rest of the time, the sacredness of Sri Chinmoy's presence followed there like a fragrance. The disciples kept it fastidiously clean, but it was full of the master's weights and other fitness equipment, pretty notepads, sumptuous artists' papers, and pots of different sorts of pens received as gifts, all surrounded by fresh bouquets and vivid prints of Hindu gods and goddesses. Beyond a set of screens draped in fabric and silk flowers, the master would usually be sitting or reclining on a couch, while one or two boys massaged the pain from his legs and feet. The first girl would approach and pause a short distance away, waiting for him to compose an aphoristic poem for his 77,000 Service Trees series. She copied it hastily into her notebook and then returned to the back of the line so the next could step forward. Of course he did not need us for any purpose. He could have used an audio recorder, or he could have called for one of his official stenographers, who would no doubt have been far more efficient. Calling us was a way of including us in his activities and of keeping us alert. He also gave us credit for inspiring him, even with our struggles and imperfections. Stepping into Sri Chinmoy's creative world was an honour in itself, but it also yielded direct tuition. All of his poems share their source in his meditation, and many speak of far loftier realms than beginners like myself could even imagine. Like the mountain guide, he would join the climb from the foothills, though, rather than just calling down directions from the summit. Many of his poems and aphorisms thus speak of inner blindness he had far transcended. But by noting and identifying with our own limited vision, he sought then to widen and brighten our view. Sometimes before composing a poem, he would first glance at a sheet of phrases and ideas. Sometimes he would retire into a faraway realm, or sometimes he would meditate on the person in front of him. Often a poem dictated in this last way would thus come from one's own life challenges, both question and reply arriving together in one tiny yet penetrating package. As no spiritual challenge is unique to an individual, in addressing our own myriad inner situations, Sri Chinmoy could speak to countless seekers traversing similar ground. Those who had been disciples for some time might hope to receive a spiritual name. It would happen when Sri Chinmoy saw that the soul was ready, so the date could not be captured by mental wonderings or calculations. He might give notice that it would be received at a certain future time, or it might come unexpectedly. Names would usually be offered towards the end of celebrations in New York, During functions, the master would sometimes take out a notepad and a few envelopes that were printed like the sky. A whisper would scatter throughout the crowds and a hallowed silence followed as he called and meditated with each person in turn before passing an envelope. The recipient would go home to meditate and repeat the new name 100 times before it would be used or told to others. The name itself would be accompanied by Sri Chinmoy's interpretation, specific to that person. In rare cases, 2 people might be given the same name at separate times, but the meanings could be quite different. At 6 years, I felt an increasing longing to know my soul's true qualities, to have at last an answer to the question, who am I? It was not something I had a right to expect, and I knew very well from past experience that focusing too much on the fruition of my hopes is a sure way to lose track of more important things. Still, that wish accompanied me everywhere, like constant music in the far distance of all my days. Though I tried not to let it grow wild like a desire or allow it to put down its roots in prayer, I often caught myself imagining the day when my turn would come. Invariably at Aspiration Ground, wearing my favourite sari, with the rustle of a cool breeze and my friends nearby. I made a special effort to silence that wish while standing before my guru, but copying down an aphorism at the front of the line one day, I knew my secret was out. My soul, how long do you want to remain undiscovered? Do you not think it pains me deeply? Sri Chinmoy's tender wording left me close to tears all that day. He spoke not on behalf of my sovereign soul, the spark of the supreme in me. He spoke instead to that very soul from the rest of me, the limited and struggling self who longed to be acquainted with it. His understanding and his plea for me brought a peaceful comfort, but the poem also seemed to form a license for my longing, and I could not so easily drive it out after that. I enjoyed far more outer contact with the master than ever before, but there was still a gulf between the inner guru and the earthly guru. For the most part, it did not trouble me. In my dreams, he was like a grandfather as always, and I a presumptuous child, one he almost could not help but indulge. I saw the worldly etiquette as necessary, and I followed it to the letter, knowing that distance was not the sum of my connection to him. My guru seemed more removed from me than from most of the other girls in Pari's group, if not all of them. It may well have been a reflection of my spiritual standing, but I preferred to assume my soul simply needed that particular handling. With me, his manner comprised disinterest at best and irritation at worst, yet I was sure I almost saw his cover crack into a smirk sometimes. It was as though we both were acting out our given roles with straight faces in the theatre of life, only at either end of the same stage. The master would often take pauses in his dictation to talk to one girl or another while the rest of us were still present, or to share an anecdote with us all. If ever he decided to speak to me outwardly, it was always done obliquely. Instead of asking me something, he would question the girl next to me, and she would reply on my behalf. It was either amusing or baffling, depending on the circumstance, but I did not need to understand. Only if he was any other than that way with me did I begin to wonder if something was wrong. When he seemed distant and somewhat dismissive, I came to assume all was well in the world. Every day brought new reminders that Sri Chinmoy's outer demeanour could not possibly form a gauge of his interior universe. He may be drawing prolifically while harbouring a head cold. He may look stern and serious, but then dictate a string of humorous poems or read out jokes from a book in the middle of a function. He may seem cosy and almost vulnerable, with a little fleecy hat on crookedly or a loose shoelace that I would long to tie more neatly for him. But the sudden glory of his words would tremble my bones with awe and remind me he was not all we could see of him. One day the master seemed to go out of his way to ignore me, such that I was sure he did not even know I was there. Most of the morning he was lying on a platform doing stomach crunches and other exercises. Pari's group took it in turns to count his repetitions in sets of 10 or 20, and a boy noted them down in a book. Later that day I felt unwell and went to rest, only to find my earlier assumptions could not have been further from the truth. "Where has Emily gone?" he asked the other girls with surprise and intense concern. "She's sick, Guru."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes.
I saw her before."
Meanwhile, I was sleeping but woke up completely recovered. Sri Chinmoy almost always noticed when one of us was missing and asked after her welfare, even in New York when we were 40 or more. On Christmas trips, we would usually only have short breaks from the hotel when the master was out for a drive. As his legs became increasingly painful, he preferred to stay inside, and so we were more likely to be called for dictation. In the afternoons, he would sit in the main function room telling stories, composing songs, or giving us poems. Other disciples could stay or go out then, so the room was only partially full. I did not mind that others had more sightseeing or shopping time than we did. The master seemed to know when we were tired or wanted a trip outside anyway, and indulged us even that girlish trifle. There was a section of the city famous for its sari shops. Although not one for traipsing around, even I was envious of the opulent bargains I had seen other girls displaying to their friends in the lobby. "Little India is waiting for you," Sri Chinmoy issued one morning after only a few poems. We were like school children on a snow day then. I was not abroad as a tourist, and I wanted nothing more than to be in my guru's presence, but somehow recreation was more precious having been withheld and later granted than if I had gone for a week of only vacationing. The longing for my name had reached ungainly proportions and followed me to Solo, Java, for the next part of the trip. I felt I almost could not take another step without knowing my soul's traits, and I had to invent new tricks to help me carry the increasing weight of that wish. One day as we filed into the master's annex, I imagined leaving the wish outside the door in a sack, like an untamed animal. I promised I would let it out to follow me afterwards if it would just stay quiet while I was with my guru. The master seemed in a conversational mood. After giving a poem to the girl next to me, he stopped to talk with her about her name. Then he looked away, but motioned his head backwards in my direction. "She has no name." I felt prickly red rising in me, knowing I was the only one in the room still with a Western name, but I noticed the corner of a smile in profile. "Her name is Emily, like Emily Dickinson. When she can prove that she has the soul of Emily Dickinson, then she will get her name." He talked at length about the poet and about his enjoyment of her psychic poetry, poetry of the heart. He went on to include other American poets in his discourse, and was about to start on British ones, but decided to resume composing his own works instead. While it seemed my guru had given me a clue as to when I would get my name, I was more puzzled than ever. I did not presume to take any of his comments literally. A man may be said to have the strength of an ox, but that does not make him an ox. A girl may be said to have her mother's eyes, but that does not leave her mother sightless for want of them. I did not assume Sri Chinmoy was telling me I was literally a reincarnation of a poet. It is human nature to imagine oneself as someone significant in a former life, rather Cleopatra than one of her nameless slaves. In the long journey of the soul, where one progresses towards the divine via countless forms and incarnations, whoever I am in this life would logically be a little closer to the goal than any before. So why would I want to cling to some previous existence? I wanted most to know who I am in this life, but I could not discern anything from the master's hint, if it even was a hint. All that day and all that night I studied his words from every angle, yet still felt none the wiser. Was I to write poetry? Was I to live more from my heart? How could I prove something that I did not understand? Eventually, by morning, I decided that if it was a clue, It was that my new name still waited a long way off, so I had better not waste more time craving it. Others left the function room for lunch. I stayed brooding in my seat while the master's food was brought to him. It was then that one of his very close disciples called me to the annex. Sri Chinmoy had apparently dictated my name and its meaning to her by phone the night before. There it was, neatly written in her hand on the simple transparent jotting paper one might find on a hotel desk. I was sweaty and tired and troubled. I was not wearing a sari at all, much less my favourite one. There was no cool breeze, and my friends were not near me. Nothing was at all like my imaginings, and nothing seemed real either. Instead of floating into some exalted state, I was completely consumed with doubts. How could I know the name was really mine if it did not come directly to me? The moment I heard the root, Mongol, auspicious, I was sure. It beat in my heart like a giant gong that rang through all my inner sky. I smiled as she spoke it, then I grinned, and then covered a laugh as the silent words came to mind. It's a sign. Shumangali, she who brings, from the Supreme, auspicious good fortune to all who are around her. Her service to the Absolute must be unconditional, and from His grace she will shed divine emanations to all. Divine sweetness and goodness emanate from her soul. Once again, the Master had gone so far out of his way to be indirect that I could only take it as the dearest care. I was certainly not aware of having proven anything at all overnight. His prior words still baffled me, but I preferred them that way. There was sport in them and mystery. I went to my room, showered and put on my favourite sari, then sat down to meditate. There was my inner guru, encouraging, fond and light-hearted, like a proud grandfather. On some level the truth registered, and I beamed with thanks for it, but it would take some time to settle more fully. When I had chanted the unfamiliar word 100 times, I went straight to the annex where the girls had been called for dictation. Although the master still retained his stoic guise, my first poem began, God has infinite names. That was my sole outer acknowledgement from him, and it was more than enough. All the rest of the day and evening, I could not meditate. I still did not consciously recognize anything except the root of my name. Instead of reaching a deeper understanding of it, though, I only seemed to manifest the antithesis of my soul's qualities. Rather than bringing good fortune, I accidentally insulted people or gave them wrong information. I spilled things on them and bumped into them. Far from a divine augury, I was a human disaster. The next day, the master did not feel like writing, only drawing. Although, of course, we were not needed, he found a way to include us in that creative realm too. He first drew birds on frames of different sizes. One by one, each girl would wait for the drawing to appear on the glass and then take it from his hand to be set on a table. The first frames were quite large, then smaller and smaller ones were used until they were no more than an inch high. It became more difficult to take those ones without brushing the master's hallowed fingers with my own by mistake. If it ever happened, I chided myself and felt miserable. When the frames were all gone, he started on large sheets of paper, resting on a board that obscured his face. In that silence and simplicity, my name began to grow in me. Standing only inches from my guru, but unable to see him, I felt as though a giant jewel of light, like a weightless diamond, was turning in my chest. Rays shone out in golden white from all directions. He seemed to be drawing for a long time as I waited, but just as during my birthday blessings, time paused or became irrelevant, and I was only willing myself to stand upright in that power. Eventually, he tilted the board with an arch's precision, enough to reveal a brief and secret smile, only to hide it again behind the page. By the time he handed me the drawing, the smile had disappeared, traceless as a drop in a pool. I treasured the brevity and sweetness of that blessing, yet more than the public one I had long thought would come to pass, at Aspiration Ground, with a cool breeze and my friends near me, a wider audience settling into the waiting hush as I held a sky-patterned envelope. I had bought my guru a shirt as a gift to thank him for my name. Although it was admittedly a beautiful shirt, jade green with fine white batik at the edges, what gift could possibly be enough under the circumstances? I wanted to give it to one of the girls who prepared his meals so she could put it discreetly by his chair before he arrived, but she would not do it. It was customary that as his spiritual grandchildren, girls from Pari's group must approach the master and offer gifts personally. For the first time ever, etiquette placed me closer to him than I even wanted to be. Must I disturb him with my trivial gift? I flushed with nerves, especially as I knew there were few opportunities before I left for home. The master had decided to dictate to us from a chair outside the function room that day. Having grown tired of the windowless interior, he wanted to be in sunlight. Rows of disciples gathered, standing or sitting on the floor, watching and listening as we approached him one by one to take poems. After some time, he called for our prasad to be laid on the ground near him. He undoubtedly entered a very high meditation then, but I knew my only chance had come. I offered the package towards him gingerly before taking the little milk drink next to his shoes. His face displayed a gradual return to earthly consciousness, perceptible in stages by the change in his expression. It was as though I had rung the doorbell of a very tall house, causing him to climb down several flights of stairs to answer it. I did not want attention then. I wanted to be invisible and undemanding, but in my granddaughter role, I had to trouble him as I would in my dreams. At last he reached out with a smile and thanked me. The name seemed to fit more snugly every day on my return home. Not that I could imagine living up to Sri Chinmoy's translation on a daily basis, but glimmers of understanding came from unexpected sources. The word that relieved me most was goodness. It meant I would never need to compare myself to those I considered great. It was their job to be towering and radiant like sunflowers. I could be myself, staying by the ground like a daisy or a primrose, and that would be enough. I discovered that my name in its literal form, auspicious good fortune, is used in India as a description of a woman who is married and whose husband is still living. Just that knowledge was a source of comfort to me. It seemed to explain why I had needed to resolve the conundrum of being single versus being unmarried. To remain unmarried was in some way inauspicious, and according to me, inauspiciousness could not exist. I still did not understand the master's comment about Emily Dickinson, but studying her poems and biographies suffused my own life with light. Although her physical form was often frail and sickly, it harboured a tempest of intensity and creativity. While she was warm and lively with those very close to her, her heart was as fresh and pliable as a child's, and would have perished in the wider world. Solitude was thus not a choice, but a necessity. Even when she had a chance of marriage, she did not take it, knowing the thin comforts of companionship would cost her far more treasured and luxuriant things in her own secret world. Contrary to her Puritan upbringing, she first found her God in nature. Rather than acquiring the fears of damnation fed to her from books and schools, she presumed an almost outrageous familiarity with him, even in his formless and formidable shapes. Her life was a triumph, despite her struggles with illness, and with a world she found unbearably insensitive. Seeing that triumph, I could begin my own life anew. Instead of considering my uniqueness a burden, it became a certain boon to me from then. I also acquired an urgent love of expression through written words.